Accession number 18499, Real 1.
John Aldridge, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
Pulham, St. Mary, Norfolk.
Where's that?
South of Norwich, about 15 miles south of Norwich.
Which year were you born?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your education at Pulham, St. Mary?
I had my early education at Pulham, St. Mary, and from there I went to Bungay Grammar School, B-U-N-G-A-Y.
And how old were you when you left there?
I left there at 17.
So, just as the war started?
So I left in 1940. July 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh yes, I heard that. Yes.
Under what circumstances?
Oh, living at home in the Sunday morning, you know, everything was waiting for it to come along and we listened to it. That was that.
And what was your reaction to the news?
I don't think there was any great reaction because we were all expecting it anyway.
Was there any sense of dismay on your part?
Not really, I don't think so. I mean, we were all geared up for it and we thought there would be shortages of one thing and another, petrol and that sort of thing. Father had stuck plenty of petrol in an old chicken shed ready if there was a shortage and that sort of thing. I'm sure we all felt that it was coming. And we went, you know, no real reaction to it.
Your father had a car, did he?
Oh, yes. Yes, he had a business.
What was his business?
Agricultural, a threshing contractor, really, in those days. The old steam engines and that sort of thing.
Did you agree with the declaration of war on Germany?
Oh, yes, I'm sure I did. Because, I mean, ever since 1936... he'd been gradually getting away with whatever he wanted, Hitler, and we realised then that we were treaty-bound with Poland and a stand had to be made somewhere.
Did the early years of the war affect you, living in Norfolk at all?
Well, I had the first, because in 1939 I was still at school. I was at school for another year, and we had a school evacuated from Grays in Essex with us, and the boys came into our forms and just integrated with us. And I suppose, apart from anything else, that was about all that happened in the early years till we approached the Battle of Britain time, and then we had bombs dropping then, and that was really, I suppose, June 1940 was really the start of any evidence that we were at war, as far as we were concerned, apart from our own aircraft flying out at night, because there were several bases in East Anglia, obviously.
How did the local boys and girls get on with the children from Grays Essex?
Well, I remember we got on very well with them. You know, the ones you didn't have much contact with, the ones that weren't in your form. I have a feeling, and it's a bit difficult to remember now, but I have a feeling they were boys of 11 and over. We didn't have any younger children. This was a grammar school that came to us, which we were, you see, from 11 years old onwards.
So they came to Bungay rather than...
That's Port. Right. Bungay, oh yes, they were at Bungay. I assume, though, I can't remember, but we did have a boarding house with the school at that time, and whether they were boarded at the boarding house or whether... they lived out with other families. I can't really remember that. Palmer School in Grays they came from. I remember the name now.
Did they seem to be any different from the Norfolk boys?
Well, not really. I think they found the environment quite different, of course, but they soon integrated.
Did you have any living at your house?
No, we never had any evacuees. We had the only... people living at our house came from, my brother lived in London and they had a young child, and his wife, when the bombing started in London, they came down and were more or less evacuees, lived with my parents.
Was there ever any bombs dropped in your area?
Oh, yes. See, Pulham, in the First World War and up to the 1930s, Pulham was an old airship station. There were two big hangars there. We saw the old airships, the R-100, R-101, the R-33, all flew out of there. And that was then converted during the war to a bomb dump. The bombs were sent out from the factories to be maintained and then issued out to the different bases where they were required. They dropped once or twice. They attempted to bomb it. Once they hit one of the hangars, I think. But and I remember that I saw an article that the only aircraft shot down over Norfolk in the Battle of Britain was in August 1940, and I did witness that.
Can you tell me what you saw?
Well, I saw this dawn, because I was keen on aircraft in those days. Like a lot of us my age were. It was a Dornier 17, came over, circled the old place once, the old air station. They called it an air station in those days, not an airfield. And I saw the bombs come out like a string of sausages, and not one exploded. They dropped actually in a field next to the station itself. And the aircraft then did a circuit and turned around to a machine gun. And from the Norwich, from the north, three Hurricanes came up. And he didn't have a chance, he was shot down straight away. And landed in the next village. And I can always remember my father was there, and we got in the car and we saw the smoke coming up from where the aircraft had crashed. And there were crowds, well, it looked like crowds from villages all around, were heading for where the smoke was going up. And such an event in those days to see an aircraft shot down, of course. And that was that piece.
Were the crew killed?
Not all of them. Pilot was killed, I think one more. I have a feeling two or three parachuted out, and I always, whether it was true or not, I always hear, because it was harvest time in the fields, and they were rounded up by the farm laborers with their pitchforks. Whether that's true, I don't know.
That was in August 1940?
40, yes. We had a bombing previous to that. One evening, there was a thunderstorm going on when I'd gone back from school. My father used to have men employed repairing the machines before the harvest started, and I said, we heard this aircraft throbbing sound. I said, that's a German, and because we went out and looked, and see it come over, see the Black Crosses even, and they bombed. They did hit the old hangar that day. It was a Junkers 88, and he disappeared into the closure and was off, because the closure was fairly low with thunderstorms around.
What was the village where the Dornier came down?
It's a place called Starston, the next village. Crashed in a wood. But you couldn't get near the aircraft, it was way over back in the field.
Did you see anything else of the Battle of Britain?
Not really. Occasionally you saw some Spitfires or Hurricanes flying over, because Coltishall which is only 5 miles from where we are now, was a fighter base. Barda was there for a time with a squadron, but apart from that, really the Battle of Britain didn't affect us at all here.
What happened to you after that summer of 1940?
Well, I started work in September in Norwich at the City Engineers Department at the City Hall. I went to digs because my brother, older brother, had been in digs, and he was a territorial, because he'd been called up before the war even started, about a fortnight before. He was in that aircraft, funnily enough. And I took over in where he'd been in digs and carried on working there until the time came when, obviously the time came when you had to decide what you're going to do in the forces. And I volunteered for air crew, and 1942 I went in, eventually, after about 6 months' wait, after passing my aircrew selection board.
Why did you volunteer for aircrew?
Well, I think we were all, propaganda was pushed at us, saying what a wonderful life it was in the Air Force and this, that and the other, and I know at school we were all very keen on flying and that sort of thing. That was a thing of the day. And that's why I went, I suppose, really. And a volunteer, well, you had to volunteer for aircrew, of course, you weren't press ganged or anything. And I went for a selection board at Cardington. And then on, then I was called up in July 1942.
What happened to you when you were called up?
Went to Lord's Cricket Ground, aircrew reception centre. Billeted in flats. I remember the block of flats, empty flats, called Stockley Hall. And the main thing I remember about being there is we used to feed at the zoo. We used to have the zoo restaurant as our dining room. We used to march every day down to the zoo for eating. Of course, previous to before I was called up, when I was in Norwich, I witnessed the bombings in Norwich in April 1942. In fact, I had a grandstand view of one of them. We all had to take turns at fire watching, and I was on top of the City Hall when some of the worst bombing was done in Norwich at the time of what the so-called Baedeker raids, when they were going to the cathedral cities and that sort of thing.
Can you describe what you saw?
Well, I can always remember we'd had a bad raid on the Monday night, and this was Wednesday when we were on duty, and we thought, well, they were going to I've been to Exeter and places like that, and we thought, well, I shouldn't think they'll come this way tonight again after being here on Monday. And of course the sirens went, and by the time we got on the roof, the flares were coming down. And we knew then that wasn't going to be anywhere else except Norwich. And of course I think they had about 20 or 30 aircraft. I mean, the raid, when you compare with the shortness of the raids I took part in later on, that took 2 hours bombing before they, you know, about 30 aircraft were bombing for it, 2 hours, and a lot of places were on fire. I always remember we seeing one aircraft across the sky, and somebody said, "Oh, our fighters are up tonight," and of course it wasn't. Next minute, the centre, this dropped right in the centre of Norwich, and the centre of Norwich was badly destroyed then. And there was another stick of bombs. The last bomb finished on the other side of the road from the City Hall. I often think they were probably aiming for it. And it was a chemist's shop. And I can always remember on the roof, prescription forms were showering down on the roof from that one. And then Cayley's was the big chocolate factory there. We saw twinkling lights in one of the windows on the at the top of the building. And then within 10 minutes, the whole place was ablaze, because chocolate and sugar and that stuff, that went up quickly. But the amazing thing there is that this block of the factory was burnt down, but there was another block which was taken over by Siemens electrical people doing more work, and that wasn't touched. And the next morning, because you went back to your digs wondering whether you were going to see the place there, so and had a big diversion to get round everywhere. And what? That was virtually it then, at the actual raid, I suppose.
What was your address in Norwich at that time?
9 Sandringham Road, Norwich.
Did any bombs fall near there?
A few incendiaries. Because everybody had buckets of sand and stirrup pumps and that sort of thing, put them out. And just up the road they bombed a church. So the next road at T-Junction was a place called Edinburgh Road. St Thomas's Church was burnt down. I had an aunt live nearly opposite that, and I remember going to see how she was, and seeing the church all ablaze.
How did public morale in Norwich stand up to that?
Well, it was a bit rough for a time. A lot of people went out of the city at night after that. Jean, she lived there, my wife, lived in Norwich at the time, and they all went out. Father took them out in the car, and they spent the night out in the country, in the woods somewhere, you know, with 2 bad raids in 3 days.
Did you come across anybody whose morale had cracked?
No, I didn't see any cracking. I mean, didn't see it at all. And we had people killed who'd worked in our office. They were firewatching down at one of the corporation depots, and that was absolutely destroyed. And one was killed, I know who'd worked with us. But apart from that, I mean, afterwards, the people were queuing up for different things, you know, who were bombed out. But things were regulated pretty well, I thought.
Where were you when the raid was actually going on then?
On the roof of the City Hall, Norwich, in the centre of Norwich. And we were there, supposed to be fireworks. You had your buckets and stirrup pumps. If incendiaries went on, you were supposed to douse them with the sand or stirrup pump and that sort of thing.
Did you feel frightened yourself?
Well, I suppose you did. But, I mean, there was absolutely no protection. We had no, virtually no anti-aircraft guns. No barrage balloons at that time. That's another funny story. Because I was firewatching, what's been in the June, just before I was going into the Air Force. And they'd brought barrage balloons, like everything else. They sort of shut the door after the horse had gone and brought these barrage balloons in after these raids. And we had a terrific thunderstorm one night. And these balloons were going up one after the other when the strikes of lightning came down. They set fire to the balloons. And they were coming down one after the other. That's the only other thing I can remember about firewatching during the war.
But during the Baedeker raid, did any bombs actually hit the city hall?
No, I feel that one, that was a stick of four. One hit, there was the old music hall there called the Hippodrome. That was damaged. It was just diagonally across the road from the city hall. As I say, the last one hit these shops on the other side of the road from the city hall. But apart from, I suppose, broken glass, there was no other damage to the city hall at all the war. Same with the cathedral. It only hit once, I think, with an incendiary.
Was there any sense of bitterness in Norwich about the raid?
There was, of course, but I mean, it had been going on for 2 years then. You had your Coventrys and your Sheffields and that sort of thing going on. You were anticipated it in a way that one day they might turn to the smaller cities. And of course, I felt that it encouraged me more perhaps to join up and go in the Air Force myself to see if I could get a little of my arm back.
Now, coming back to your own RAF training, you were at St John's Wood, you said?
Yes, that's where we had to report to Lord's Cricket Ground. We were in St John's Wood for kitting out and inoculations and that sort of thing. I don't know, about a fortnight there, I suppose. And then we went to, we didn't go straight to initial training wing, where your initial training was done. We went to a camp down at Ludlow in Shropshire under canvas and sort of did toughening up work, I suppose, chopping wood and all that sort of thing, and living under campfire conditions, cooking the porridge on the old campfire outside and that sort of thing for about another fortnight, I suppose, before we went on to initial training wing.
What happened to you then?
Well, I was lucky. A lot of them went to coastal places, but I went to Stratford-on-Avon, which was very nice, and we were billeted in what was then called the Washington Irving Hotel, and we did all our basic marching and training and bookwork, hygiene, initial navigation, mathematics, aircraft identification and that sort of thing. Learned Morse code. Took Morse code from an Aldous lamp. I always remember we stood down in the Shakespeare Memorial Gardens and the chap flashed the Aldous lamp from the top of the Memorial Theatre for us to read the Morse, which was quite interesting. And yes, that was a nice place to be, actually. I've tried, after the war, I tried to find a Washington Irving, because Washington Irving was an old actor, apparently. And I tried to find it and couldn't find it, and I saw the place where it was, and I said, well, is that right? Was that the Washington? They said, yes. I asked the policeman. He said, yes, that's now called the Red Cow. It turned into a pub. And part of it, because the biggest hotel, is now Marks and Spencer's store as well. It's got a plaque on the wall somewhere there, but considering that. It was a Washington Irving Hotel. And that was about, a couple of months' course, I suppose.
And then?
Then, from then on, you went to this grading school. We were posted up to Anstey, near Coventry, and flew tiger moths. It was about 10 hours. And they graded you then, whether you were going to grade you as a... It was... Well, the scheme was called the PNB, pilot navigator bomber scheme, in those days, the training scheme. And you were then, if you were graded a pilot, well then, of course, you passed on to pilot training. We flew from a little aerodrome called Southam, which was outside Coventry. Anstey didn't have an extra flying field. And did these 12 hours, or 10 hours, I think it was, on Tiger Moths. And they assessed you then and graded you, as I say.
How did you get on with flying?
Oh, I quite liked it. I was graded pilot, and then you were awaited transport to, well, eventually, to either Rhodesia or Canada or somewhere like that for your ongoing training on the Commonwealth training scheme.
Where did you go to?
Well, after that, which happened all the while in training, I must admit, you wasted so many weeks. I was posted down to St Athan in Wales and did about an engines course, because it was a technical training school for mechanics. And you learnt all the old what engines are about, the Otto cycle, as they call it, how the engine worked, and all various bits and pieces like that, which was about another 3 weeks, I should think. And then you were posted up to Manchester, Heaton Park in Manchester, which was the transit camp for going overseas. And that finished my this side of the water, anyway. Finished my service this side of the water till you were posted overseas.
What was your voyage to Canada like?
Very nice, very nice. I was on the Queen Elizabeth I, the old original Queen Elizabeth liner. Because going out, obviously, there weren't many people travelling out, just RAF trainees and that sort of thing. There was no military people going out there, and that was we had bunks, splendid accommodation, RAF wise anyway. And about a 5-day voyage to Halifax, and then on to Moncton, which was another transit base, Moncton in Nova Scotia. And then you were sorted out where you were going for your elementary training, and I was posted out to Saskatchewan, a place near Moose Jaw in Saskatchewan called Caron, number 33 AFTS. And there we flew Cornells, which were monoplanes, nice little aircraft, and I soloed, and shortly after that, the axe came down, and about, I don't know, six of us who were good friends were all taken off the course and told to remuster. They badly wanted me to remuster as a navigator, but for some reason most of us wanted to get back quicker, and the air bombers course was quicker, shorter.
Why did you want to get back so quick?
I don't know. We wanted to get flying, I suppose, in the war, I think, which was, when you look back now, you were silly. But nevertheless, I really must as a bomb aimer, and three of my friends, we all stuck together, and we were all then posted to a depot at Brandon in Manitoba to await posting out to another unit for further training as air bombers.
How did you feel about having to remuster as an air bomber?
Well, we were all a bit disappointed in that, but there we are. That was how things were going in those days. I mean, it was even worse later on. I think a lot of chaps that did go right through and get their wings as pilots never did get through as pilots flying. In fact, we had a rear gunner who was a pilot. Well, after the Manning Depot, I was posted to number 7 bombing gunnery school at a place called Dauphin in Manitoba. Up in the sort of lakes and woods district, a bit that was in north of, not so much prairie land as I've been used to. Lovely part, really. And by a place called Lake Dauphin. And there we did our bombing training, initial bombing training, and gunnery, because we were meant to be front gunners in the four engine aircraft, the bomb aimers were. And I did gunnery training flying in a Bolingbroke, which is the Canadian version of the Blenheim. And the target towing aircraft were Lysanders. And when you'd completed that course, you were ready to go on to air navigation school.
What did you think of the quality of the training that they were giving in Canada?
Oh, quite good. Well, of course, I mean, the equipment was like your bomb sights and that sort of thing, were the old equipment, but I mean, that gave you the basic ideas of it all. But of course, when you got back here, your equipment's altogether different.
What was the discipline like in Canada?
Oh, quite. I mean, it wasn't terribly strict. It was, and to some extent. I can always remember at this Manning depot, in the morning we had an inspection first thing, and this flight sergeant tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Get your hair cut." So I went and had my hair cut. In the afternoon we paraded again, he tapped me on the shoulder again. And I said, "Well, I had it this morning." He said, "Well, that doesn't look very short." But, I mean, discipline otherwise was quite good. You know, we weren't harassed, and the food, of course, was wonderful. It was wonderful. You couldn't believe it when we first landed there, you know. Food was there, whatever you wanted, and the food provided by the service itself was wonderful stuff.
Did you have any contact with Canadian civilians?
Yes, well, as I said, when we had a bit of a wait at this Manning depot at Brandon, and they gave us, I think, a fortnight's leave. And we all wanted to go through to the Rockies for spend some time there, but they didn't pay us. They only paid us about a week's money, and we didn't have enough money to get there. So we went to Winnipeg instead. And if you went to one of the service associations, they would put you on to people who had put you up for a week or two. And I went to Mrs. Williams, I can remember the name, stayed there while we had our leave with my special mate I had, Gordon. And we spent that time in Winnipeg, which was rather nice. Well, from there, once you've finished your bombing and gunnery course, you were then posted to Air Navigation School, which was the one I went to was in Ontario by Lake Huron, called Port Albert. There you did more navigation, you did bombing and stuff, and photography. Handheld photography. We had the door open on the Ansons, and you used to take photographs, what they called handheld photography, in different places you were told to photograph them. Of course, you never did use it again, mind you, once you got back, once you were trained. And then if you were good enough, if you got through the course all right, you were then given your brevet, ready to come back home again. And one terrible incident I remember, they used to divide you up. I was Aldridge. I used to fly with a chap called Barton, because they used to pay you up in alphabetical order, was on this course, and I've flown with him several times. And we were watching a football match one evening, and he suddenly went down, and he had an epileptic fit. And we, you know, somebody putting a pencil in his mouth, keeping his teeth apart, and of course he was taken off to the sick quarters, and he admitted he'd never said that he had had fits before he joined up, but he'd never mentioned it. And I often think I'm glad he didn't have one when he was flying with me. But that's the only incident I can remember really on that course.
Was Canada a good place to do training in?
Oh yes, well, it was very good. Too good really, because I mean, as far as navigation goes, I mean, the roads are all north, south, east or west, and the rail, everything stood out so well. At night time all the towns were lit up. I mean, your navigation was, well, it wasn't.